Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, your host and the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, just remind people to like and subscribe to the channel so other people can find out about it. We've been growing a lot this year. We really revamped the podcast this year. We've been growing a lot, so just continue to tell people about it. Write good reviews, like, subscribe, all that stuff. So I appreciate it. Thank you. So today we're talking with Casey Chalk, and he is a contributing editor at the New Oxford Review, a senior contributor for The Federalist, and a frequent contributor to American Conservative. But most importantly, he's a frequent contributor to Crisis Magazine. We always love his articles at Crisis. He holds an undergraduate degree in history, a master's in teaching, and a master's in theology. And that last one's from Christendom College, which I know a lot of our people listening are familiar with that great college. But what we are going to talk about today is he's most recently the author of The Persecuted, True Stories of Courageous Christians Living Their Faith in Muslim Lands, published by Sophia Institute Press, coming out later this month. You said it was due out on the 23rd. So welcome to the podcast, Casey.
Thanks, Eric. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah, of course. This is something, you know, this is one of those situations where you're writing about a subject that should be a big deal, but it's actually not a big, it's not on people's radar. I should have put it that way, like it should be. How did it get on your radar, though? How did you find out about this and get so interested in this topic? Because you've not only written this book, but you've written a lot of articles about it in the past. And of course, you've had personal experience, but how did you get interested in this?
Yeah, a couple articles actually for Crisis over the last few years. I've been really interested in the plight of persecuted Christians around the world going back to when I was in high school. I think because of my parents, my mom and dad, it was something that they cared about. We were evangelical at the time. So even when I was in seminary, I took a class from a former Muslim who converted to Christianity named Patrick Sukdeo. And actually, I cite a lot of his scholarly work in the book. But the immediate impetus for The Persecuted was from my time in Thailand. My wife, Claire, and I, we moved there with our one-year-old daughter in 2014. We were there for 3 years until 2017. Yeah, we left with three kids, so we had two there. The crisis of persecuted Christians in Muslim countries actually has all kinds of interesting and sad consequences, which, like, as I describe in The Persecuted, result in a big asylum seeker crisis in far-flung places like Bangkok, Thailand, which is, you know, thousands of miles removed from Pakistan.
Yeah, and so in the book, you talk about living in Thailand for a few years and really encountering a lot of the people seeking asylum and how many of them are Christian. And I thought that was interesting because when you first said in the book that you went to Thailand, I'm like, wait a minute, what's this got to do with, I didn't quite get the connection, but then I realized that that's the case. So give the basic situation for a Christian living in Pakistan today.
Yeah. So listeners may be familiar with some of the more famous stories regarding the persecuted church in Pakistan. Asia Bibi is probably the one that folks would immediately come to mind for people. Pakistan's Christian population is very ancient, very historic, goes back to, I think, maybe 7th or 6th century AD. But the numbers started to increase pretty dramatically when the British were in control of the Indian subcontinent, right? When India and Pakistan were a single nation under the British Empire in the 18th and 19th centuries. There were a lot of conversions. There were a lot of Catholic missionaries, various orders, the Jesuits, the Augustinians, several others, and they won a lot of converts, particularly amongst the lower classes of Indian and what is now Pakistani society. Fast forward into the 1940s when India and Pakistan split. Pakistan is formed as a Muslim nation, explicitly a Muslim nation, but with a sizable religious minority community, both Christians, Hindus, Sikhs. And you can see it on the flag there on the front cover of the book, right? The green is the color of Islam, but the white is supposed to represent the minority community. Unfortunately, over the course of Pakistan's history, since the mid-20th century, the country and particularly the people of Pakistan have become increasingly antagonistic towards its Christian minority community, which really is only a couple percentage points, probably somewhere between, 1 to 3% of the population is Christian. The worst thing right now for Christians in Pakistan is the blasphemy law, which basically makes it a crime to say anything blasphemous about Allah. Well, Allah is understood according to Muslims. Allah is, you know, just means God. So it's the same, you know, Arabic Christians use Allah as well. But the Quran, Muhammad, anything that can be interpreted as an insult to those things comes with pretty heavy prosecutorial authority, including execution. In the case, Asia Bibi was supposed to be executed for having insulted Islam. Thankfully, she was able to get out of the country. So that's what Christians are up against. And so, of course, there's like the explicit persecution of, you know, Muslim extremists who are coming after these Christian minority communities, trying to force them to convert, abducting young women and forcing them to marry Muslim men. A lot of times, you know, in Islamic law, right, if they can have a certificate from, you know, signed by some imam saying, you know, this young woman has been married off to a man, the Pakistani court is going to recognize it as legitimate. So this happens. I think the estimates are about 1,000 women every year are abducted and married forcibly to Muslim men. And then there's just general violence committed against Pakistani Christians, which has intensified in the last couple of decades. Right. So there have been major incidents that have attracted some international media attention. There have been attacks. There was an attack on a big picnic on Easter in I think it was in Lahore, which is one of the major cities of Pakistan, several years ago, that killed, I want to say, like more than 70 people. These things happen pretty regularly that Pakistani Christians are killed. And then, of course, there's just the soft persecution of the fact that these Christians are typically in lower class jobs. They have difficulty finding work and they're segregated to a large degree because they want to avoid being targeted by Islamic extremists.
Right. And one thing you mentioned, you know, you mentioned how they get persecuted because of these different blasphemy laws. And somebody might say, well, maybe a Christian should be smart and not insult Muhammad or whatever. But you tell in the story that it's often a setup that basically they just, I think there's a story where you say they forced a damaged Quran into the hands of a Christian. And now all of a sudden he is accused of tearing up a Quran or something like that. Right.
Right. You know, I have to wonder if amongst some of these Muslim extremists, they don't have sort of like, you know, five steps to accusing a Christian of blasphemy. And one of them, yeah, is this because I describe one incident that happened to a family that I got to know very well in Thailand of Pakistani Catholics. This is not unusual where they will either find it a Quran that's ripped up, or they will do it themselves and then basically put it in the hands of a Christian who doesn't know what's going on, videotape it, take pictures, and then accuse them of having committed blasphemy. And in the case of the particular gentleman that I didn't know him personally, but I knew all of his family, he was a medical doctor. This isn't just like some guy, you know, working as a janitor or something like that, like a very well-respected Christian medical professional in Pakistan. And perhaps in some reason, that's why the extremists hated him even more, because there was a sense of jealousy about that. Thankfully, he was able to be hustled out of Pakistan and now lives in the Netherlands.
Right. And then wasn't there a nurse who gave a shot and it broke like Ramadan or something, the Ramadan fast or something like that. And she was kind of set up with that too, right?
Yeah, that's Mariam. I know her very well because we spent 3 years getting to know her and her husband, Wilson, and their extended family. Yeah. And again, yeah, medical professional, you know, worked with Muslims every day at a major hospital in Karachi. And just like you said, Eric, she was, performing an injection on a Muslim man. I presume there was something about her that triggered the fact that he knew she was a Christian, whether she was wearing a cross or just the fact that she didn't have her head covered. So he just, you know, created this false charge that she had, injected him when he was supposed to be doing his fast for Ramadan, it's absurd. A lot of these, as someone who's traveled in the Muslim world pretty extensively, a lot of these Muslims are not even abiding by the Ramadan fasts, but it can be used as a tool in order to antagonize Christians. And in that case, things were pretty, you know, violent and dangerous. She ended up having to flee the hospital with her husband and was shot at as she was, as they were getting into a taxi cab. And when they got to their got back to their home, there were bullet holes in the cab. So they were almost killed.
Right. And then there's not really, what is the legal recourse that a Christian in Pakistan would have in Pakistan for a false charge like this, or just the harassment they get? Because, for example, if somebody's harassing my family continually here in the United States, I go to the police, I say, this person's harassing me, and, you know, some type of legal action is taken. But can a Christian do that in Pakistan? Can they, you know, and if so, what would happen if they did?
In terms of the general harassment, no. I mean, a lot of these Christians are poor, so they're not going to be able to, you know, leverage, you know, legal, like some sort of legal defense or, you know, make a complaint. A lot of times they do go and make complaints and the police are terrified and are just as beholden to a lot of these extremists as the Christians are, in the sense that the police don't want to antagonize the extremists and then be themselves accused of, you know, being collaborators with the Christians or pawns of the West or something like that. And I talk about an example like this where someone was abducted and the brother-in-law went and filed a police report at the local police station. And then when he described all of the events and that it involved these Muslim extremists, the police just tore the report up and they said, we're not going to deal with this, right? Because in Pakistan, it's even the police and the military who are being targeted by these extremists and killed in large numbers. So they're not going to, you know, come to the defense of Christians, unless it's something really egregious and attracts international headlines, like the Asia Bibi story did. So, I mean, to some extent, Eric, the answer is, if you're being harassed and attacked and suffering under the blasphemy law, you know, what is your recourse? Having Pope Benedict the 16th talk about it during one of his homilies in Rome, that'll help.
Yeah, because that's really what set that made that in a global news story, was when he mentioned her plight. Now, tell us a little bit. You write about a friend of yours, Wilson Williams, correct? That's his name. Yep. Wilson Williams, which you met in Thailand, but tell about the story of him and his family. Just give an overview. You go in very well in the book. I recommend everybody buy the book to really read about this, but give an overview about what his life and his family's life was like in Pakistan that caused him to have to flee.
So Wilson is actually the brother of the medical doctor I mentioned earlier who, fled to the Netherlands. Wilson, like, and his wife Mariam is the nurse who was accused of doing the injection during Ramadan. Wilson is also a nurse by profession. So after the incident with his wife, basically him and his entire family were persona non grata in their community. The Muslims started, you know, basically circulating his name, photos of them. So it became a very tenuous situation for them, very dangerous. So they started to flee to other communities elsewhere in Karachi, the city where they lived, and then even outside of Karachi, trying to, you know, avoid the attention of these Islamic extremists. Two of his nieces at one point were identified in the street as being Christian and being related to Wilson. And they were actually these Islamic extremists tried to take them away and then set them on fire. I didn't see that, but when I was living in Thailand, they showed me the burn marks on their torsos and they were very extensive. After all of this happened, Wilson and his family started they were a well-known family. They're considered middle class, so they had a little bit of money. So they were able to put together enough money in order to get passports. To fly at the time their 16 member family to Thailand, which, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, Americans know like how much international travel is, right? I mean, they basically emptied out almost all of their life savings in order to fly everyone that had been identified by the Muslim extremists, including Wilson's mother and father, who I think at the time were already pretty old and starting to suffer from mild forms of dementia. And by the time I met them in Thailand, they were in pretty poor health. And actually, God rest his soul, Wilson's father just died a couple weeks ago in Bangkok.
So, I mean, the situation, I just want to remind everybody who's listening, watching, that this is solely because they're Christian. I mean, this is the only reason because that this is happening to them. If they had just said, I'll acknowledge Muhammad as prophet and become Muslim, none of this would happen to them. So we talk about, We think about the martyrs, the persecutions of the past, and we like to focus on maybe in the Roman Empire, things like even maybe in China, stuff like that. But, you know, this is going on in Pakistan right now. So tell another, I want you to also briefly mention a story of another man you focus on in the book, and that's Michael D'Souza. Tell us a little bit about his story of what he had to go through there in Pakistan.
Yeah, so Michael's story is very similar to Wilson's and Asia Bibi's for that matter. But a little different in that, you know, if you were to meet Wilson today, Wilson is very soft spoken. I'm not a very tall guy. Wilson's about my size. He's just a very unassuming, you know, nice guy. And Michael is very nice as well. But Michael is a little bit more of sort of like, you know, your aggressive Christian apologist. He's the kind of guy who's not afraid to speak what's on his mind about the Catholic faith. And I think because of that, he attracted a lot of attention from Muslim extremists in Karachi. I should probably give a little bit of historical background also to understand why it is that this has become such an issue in Karachi in particular. So there didn't used to be a lot of Muslim extremists there, but since the invasion of Afghanistan by US and NATO forces in 2001, a lot of the Pashtun ethnic group in Afghanistan came into the western parts of Pakistan, where there's also a lot of Pashtuns. And then the US government, right, and the US military started to try and get them in western Pakistan too, with like drone strikes and other stuff like that, right? So ethnic Pashtuns typically follow a more extreme form of Islam. The Diobandi school, which is connected with Wahhabism, if some listeners are familiar with that form of Islam, which is promoted by the Saudi government. And a lot of the madrasas in Pakistan are funded by the Saudis. So they're getting inculcated with these like really extreme beliefs in Islam regarding hatred of the West, that there should be no Christians in their society because it makes their land impure, that sort of thing. So a lot of these Pashtuns end up coming into big major cities in Pakistan, like Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad, and they set up camp there, right? And then once they're there, they notice, oh my gosh, there's Christians around here. We got to solve this problem, mm-hmm. right? So that's the explanation of why this is happening more in some of the major urban areas. Anyway, so with Michael, he did a number of different jobs. He's not as well educated as Wilson is. He worked at a school, it's sort of like as a janitor, like an administrative role. He worked for American Express as a courier for a while. But once he attracted the attention of Muslim extremists, they just started hounding him. And he refused to give an inch, right? He was very outspoken in saying, I believe in Christ. I have no interest in worshiping Allah. When his dad died, several Muslims, these ethnic Pashtuns, showed up at his house under the auspices of, you know, expressing their condolences over the loss of his father, but then basically turned the conversation to, you need to convert, and if you don't convert, you're going to have problems. Michael refused, and after that, it became a lot more dangerous. They attacked and assaulted him on a number of occasions, oftentimes when him and his family were going to church or coming back from church. So he has taken a brutal beating over many years from Islamic extremists. And eventually it got so bad that, you know, he really thought he was going to die. So he took his wife and at the time two children to Thailand. And I should also mention the reason why everyone's going to Thailand, I don't know if I explained that at the beginning, is Thailand is based, it's a tourist economy, right? I think we're talking like 15 to 20% of the economy is based on tourism, which means they make it really easy to get in. So you can fly from anywhere in the world to Thailand and they will give you a 30-day visa. It's not like a lot of other countries, right, where you got to go and get all that visa stuff taken care of beforehand. Pakistanis learn about this. They learn about it through human traffickers or other people that have done it before. And so they go to Thailand and they hope to get refugee status. There's a big UN HCR, High Commissioner for Refugees office in Bangkok. And they can apply for refugee status. And then the UNHCR will process that application. The Pakistanis don't realize it takes a long time, 1 to 2 years typically. And most of the time, the applications are denied. So then that means you're stuck. You don't have anything to do. You can appeal that decision. That takes another 1 or 2 years. So now we're talking, these Pakistanis have been in Bangkok 4 or 5 years. And like with the case of Wilson's family, I think they arrived in Thailand in 2012. So we're coming up on almost 10 years that they have been sort of like in this limbo position. And that's what happened to Michael and his family. They showed up and they were there for years. They had a third kid while they were in Bangkok. It's just this ongoing tragedy.
So they flee from Pakistan. A lot of Christians will flee from Pakistan and they go to Thailand because, as you said, it's easy to get in. But then I assume the process, you talk a little bit about in the book about the process of getting asylum, and it just sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare. And I mean, I think you mentioned how, I think it was Wilson's dad has Alzheimer's, and they're saying, well, he had inconsistencies in his answer, so that's a reason not to give him asylum. It's like, well, he can't even remember what he had for breakfast that morning, I think you mentioned. Right. And so like, what is the, so give us an idea of the sense of what it's like for a Pakistani Christian who has fled from Pakistan, living in Thailand, trying to get asylum. What is their life like there?
Typically, it's not a very pleasant life, even for families like Wilson's, who were very integrated into the local Catholic parish that we attended, which was a real mix. Only about half of the parish was Thai. The rest was expats like my wife and I, from other parts of the West, like the UK, Australia, lots of Africans, very international community. But, Wilson's family was well known. They did a lot of service work at the church. They basically became employees of the parish. And so they lived a stone's throw from it. But 16 family members in two cement floor rooms and, packed in there, sleeping every night, no air conditioning. And that was that's been their life for years. So obviously they don't spend a lot of time in there. They just hang out at the church all day long, and whatever the church needs, they do it, right? If there's an event, someone's got to, pull the chairs out. Someone needs to do, trash pickup, cleanup afterwards. They do that. They hand out bulletins on Sunday. They do anything. So they're the lucky ones. A lot of Pakistanis, especially if they don't live near a church or something like that, they basically just, they get by, they scrape by on whatever they can from, the charity of, people at Catholic or evangelical churches in the city. And then they just descend on the churches on Saturday nights and Sundays when churches usually have their religious services, trying to, beg for money and whatnot. So it's a really meager living. There are some resources. The Catholic Bishops Conference in Thailand has devoted, they've created an organization to try and help these people. And there's a couple other international organizations that are involved. There's one that provides legal services to the Pakistanis when they try to apply for the refugee status. But even with all of that, these folks are basically trying to live on, the equivalent of like 50 cents to a dollar a day.
Right. And you said, so they get a 30-day visa. And then if they apply for asylum, while they're in the process of applying, are they there legally, or could they be just basically after 30 days? Technically, they could be just thrown out if the government authorities want to, right?
Right. So once the 30-day visa expires, the Thai authorities can pick them up and do whatever they want to them. Most of the time, they don't deport them. What they do is they do these raids periodically, and they will put them in what's called the IDC, Immigration Detention Center, which my wife and I visited a lot because one of the main families, the D'Souza family, was in the IDC multiple times. The second time for 10 months. The IDC is not a pleasant place. No one would want to go there. I mean, it's, people know that prisons in the United States are bad, multiply that by 10. And that's what the IDC is like. It's filthy. It's dangerous. Tons of people in small quarters, contaminated food. Illness is rampant. There's a lot of corruption. The Thai police do not treat them well. And it's just a real disaster. What you can do, and what we did on a couple of occasions, is you can pay to get these people out, right? So it actually becomes a good money-making scheme for the Thai immigration and police authorities, where if you pay the equivalent of, I think I want to say it was something like $1,500, you would be able to to get out a single person, right? And then the Thais basically say like, okay, you've got another like what 30 or 60 days to get all your stuff straightened out. Otherwise, you're here illegally again. Well, of course, nobody can do that.
Right.
So they reach the limit, and then the process starts all over again. They throw them back in jail.
And I think you already said this, but what percentage of the people who are applying for refugee status are actually approved in general?
It's minuscule. Okay. I mean, like less than 10%. I think it might be like less than 5%. Unfortunately, even like the people like Wilson's family, they have. Like their story was reported on in Pakistani media, right? Like it's in the book. I show like it's in Urdu. So, unless readers know Urdu, they're not going to be able to understand it. But, I have enough reading where I can kind of figure it out. And, there's evidence. There is tangible evidence that they were persecuted And even that was not good enough. Their claim was denied by UNHCR, in part for what, you know, what you described, Eric, which is, you know, they have to provide verbal testimony, and that's very difficult, especially through a translator, oftentimes who's Muslim and who's not sympathetic to their story anyway. So yeah, most of the time they're rejected. And also, the I think I mentioned in the book is that this is really messed up. A lot of times Pakistanis, they know about other stories, right? Because they've read the newspapers or they've listened to the radio. They use those stories themselves, right? And so if the UNHCR hears a story that's already been told to them like 6 months before, they're like, no, you know, this is probably like someone else. But I think that's probably what happened in Wilson's case, is that someone probably had used his story already. And UNHCR, you know, was not going to approve another case that was so similar. The other thing that's really terrifying and sad to realize is that even if you get refugee status, right, which is like this gold standard that, you know, all the Pakistani asylum seekers are desperate to get, the UN only repatriates about 1% of those people annually, right? So I don't remember the number of how many people are actually listed as a refugee globally right now. I think it's in the tens of thousands. And, you know, only a small number of those people are going to actually get, you know, end up in the United States, Canada, the Netherlands, the handful of other countries that take refugees. So even getting refugee status doesn't necessarily solve your problems.
Right. So you're persecuted in Pakistan. You have to flee for your life. You get to Thailand. You are basically there illegally and being harassed there just because of that. You apply for refugee status. It's unlikely that you will get that. And if you do get that, you're still probably not going to be able to leave Thailand. Is that basically the plight that they have?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and even if you get the refugee status, it could be 5, 10, 15 years before you find a home.
Right. Now, you touched on it a little bit, and I want to ask you a little bit about how this happened. How is it that we have Christians in Pakistan in particular, and of course in other places in the world as well, being persecuted by Muslims? Is this something that has been going on for very long? Is it more recent? And you mentioned the connection with Americans, the war in Afghanistan, and obviously after 9/11, stuff like that. How does that all tie together? Like, has it been an increase because of the American response to 9/11? Has it been the same? And kind of how is all that tied together?
Yeah, sure. So the persecution or, you know, oppression of Christian minorities in Muslim countries has been going on since the very beginning. You know, like I think one of the very first articles I ever wrote for Crisis was talking about, you know, the fact that when Islam first, you know, conquered a lot of the lands in the Mediterranean, these were predominantly Christian countries. And there was, you know, hard and coercive measures that were used to convert people to Islam, and sometimes soft measures that took a lot longer, multiple generations. People, you know, if a Christian and a Muslim got married, the kids have to be raised Muslim, right? So that's a good way to sort of like slowly breed out Christianity. But things have accelerated quite a bit in places like Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world in the last generation. I think starting in the 80s and 90s, as you know, more militant forms of Islam became more popular. You know, like I mentioned before, right? So the Saudis and the United States and Pakistan collaborated to fight against the Soviets when they invaded Afghanistan. Folks may have, you know, seen Charlie Wilson's War and kind of familiar with that story, right? So it was a great alliance as far as it went in terms of getting the Soviets to suffer and then evacuate Afghanistan. But it was pretty bad ultimately for Pakistani Christians, because it sort of opened the door for these more extreme forms of Islam via Saudi Arabia to, you know, become popular in places like Pakistan. And then it's not just happening in Pakistan. The Saudis are funding madrasas even in Thailand. Even in southern Thailand is a majority Muslim. Some of those madrasas are funded by the same extremist form of Islam. So the Saudi influence doesn't help any. And then U.S. foreign policy in many respects has also become a big trigger for persecution of Christians. A lot of this has to do with the fact that when Muslims see the West invading Dar al-Islam, the land of Islam, right? Any place that's majority Muslim, that's part of Islam. And even the places that used to be majority Muslim and aren't, that's a short list, right? Like Spain and, you know, some of the Balkans, right? They still, the extremists still view that as part of Islam. But yeah, so anytime that the U.S., you know, when they invaded Afghanistan, when they invaded Iraq, militant Muslims want to blame somebody for that. And when they see Christians in their community, they view those Christians as, you know, part of the reason why the West is attacking, you know, Islamic nations, right? And of course, with Afghanistan, with the Taliban fleeing into Pakistan, then you've got a really big problem because, you know, you've got tens of thousands of Taliban or Taliban sympathizers coming into these areas that actually have Christian populations, right? I mentioned it in The Persecuted at one point. They interviewed a police chief in Karachi, where a lot of these Christians live, and asked, like, well, how many Muslim extremist sympathizers do you have in your city? And he said, oh, I don't know, a couple hundred thousand. You know, so when you have that big of a problem, then it's gonna trickle down to affect Christian communities. So yeah, I know, obviously, you know, the U.S. government did not invade Afghanistan thinking that it was going to have this detrimental effect on Christians. Unfortunately, that is what has happened.
Right. Now, when we hear stories like this of Wilson or Michael and all these people going through this terrible plight, there can be for American Christians, I think there can be somewhat of a kind of throw up your hands and say, what the heck can I do? I mean, obviously pray for them, but is there anything practically that we can actually do to help people like Wilson, people like Michael, these people who are, they should be our heroes in the faith because they could have converted. And I bet you one thing that's not told a lot is I bet you there are Christians who do become Muslim because of the harassment, the persecution. Yet these men and women, they don't. So what can we do anything to help them other than obviously praying for them is very important. But other than that, is there anything practical we can do to help them?
Yeah. So the good thing about The Persecuted and its story is that I provide a number of ways that I myself and my wife have tried to help these folks in ways that, you know, readers and listeners can do the same. I think this is a place where Christians can plug in and actually have some impact, right? So, of course, you know, donating to charitable causes that help persecuted Christians in places like, you know, in Muslim majority lands like Pakistan and Iraq and Syria, and even Thailand, it certainly can help. You know, the Knights of Columbus even has an arm, a fundraising arm dedicated solely to helping persecuted Christians. There's lots of other Catholic organizations. I think the USCCB has something. I mentioned that, like, the Thai Bishops Conference actually has an organization, right, that people can give money to help these people. But apart from that, like, the Barnabas Fund is when I was a Protestant, that's a very prominent Protestant organization that highlights and tries to help persecuted Christian communities in Muslim lands. Apart from that, look, the articles that I wrote on behalf of Wilson and Michael, we were able to give those to an organization here in the States that advocates on behalf of them. And that organization briefed a congressional subcommittee a couple years ago, that Chris Smith, a very devout Catholic,
he's great.
Familiar with him. Yeah. Represented from New Jersey, who cares a lot about, the plight of persecuted Christians. Ilhan Omar was also, and a Karen Bass, two pretty well-known, liberals were also on that committee, and they had some pretty interesting things to say that you can read about in The Persecuted.
I bet.
Don't terribly reflect well on them and their understanding of this problem. But, you know, that was us just contacting, you know, organizations here in the States and contacting politicians, right? Like, Jerry Connolly is my representative in Northern Virginia. We've bothered him a lot. My in-laws in Atlanta have bothered their representatives, right? I think the more that we just put this on politicians' radar and let them know that their own constituents care about this issue, we might be able to get some traction to do something about this problem.
Would it help any if we bought your book and sent it to our congressman?
Yeah,
that's what we need to do. Okay, so that's what everybody do. That's your action item for people, is buy Casey's book and send it to your congressman or woman, and so it gets on their radar more that this is an important issue. One thing I meant to ask earlier, and I'm just curious, you might not know the answer to this, but do you know the percentage breakdown of the Christians as far as, is it mostly Catholic, mostly evangelical, Orthodox? Like, what in general, the ones coming from Pakistan, do you know what the breakdown is?
The ones coming from Pakistan, I'm going to say it's very difficult to do survey on this stuff because, of course, a lot of these Pakistanis are not interested. You know, they want to stay low on the radar.
That's right.
But just based on like anecdotally, I would say majority Catholic.
A majority Catholic.
Yeah. There's one main evangelical church in Bangkok where a lot of the Pakistanis also go. So I think it's also a very large sort of like non-denom evangelical presence as well.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, good. I think that I'm going to wrap it up there, but I just want, first of all, encourage everybody to buy The Persecutor. I'll have a link to it from Sophia Institute Press. It should be out pretty soon, so you can pre-order it now. How else can people find out about, you write for New Oxford Review, The Federalist, American Conservative, and Crisis Magazine. Where can people find out about all your writings?
Sure. I have a website, caseychalk.com, where the links for the book are there and also links to all the other places where I write. Folks can definitely check me out there. And of course, anytime I write for Crisis.
Yeah, exactly. I'll link to that as well. Now, can people buy your book from your website?
Or no, they should go to the Sophia Institute.
Okay, perfect.
Press.
We'll send them there.
You want to give any more money to Bezos?
Yeah, I've been beating that drum. I'm telling everybody, please buy from the publisher or directly from the author. Don't buy from Amazon. We get nothing when you buy it from Amazon as authors.
Right.
So
right.
Now there's the publisher. So, okay, well, good. I'm just writing down a note to make sure I have all those links in there. Great. Well, thank you very much, Casey, for being on the program. And I would encourage, I didn't want to make it sound like I'm dismissing the power of prayer, obviously. I would encourage everybody to pray very much for these, our brothers and sisters. I mean, that's what they are. They're our brothers and sisters who are going through this. We don't really have a comprehension of that in America or Canada or places like that, but they have to live through this all the time. So I just encourage everybody to pray for them very much so. Yeah.
And prayer works. Wilson was able to get 4 members of his family Schengen visas in order to go and repatriate to the Netherlands, where they now live. His wife and 3 children are there. He stayed in Thailand in order to take care of his elderly parents and help the rest of the family to get out. But I credit that to God 100%. God made that happen. Mm-hmm. His children have learned Dutch and are making a new life in the Netherlands. So
that's great.
God comes through.
Yeah, amen. That's great. That's great. Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for listening or watching. And until next time, God love you.